Hey, wonderfuls. Welcome to episode 457 of the JV Club with my wonderful guest, Beth Lapides. She has been around for quite some time in an awesome way, creator of a little something called the Uncabaret that you'll hear us talk much more about during the episode, as well as her new audiobook that has lots of wonderful contributions from other amazing folks called So You Need to Decide. I know you'll enjoy this episode. You're not going to have to decide whether to enjoy it or not. I'm so sorry, but please enjoy the episode. Don't let my horrible punning ruin that for you.
I can't believe it's taken us this long to meet
somehow. I know. We've been circling each other for so many years.
We have so many people in common.
I know. It's outrageous. And of course, I knew who you were long before I'm sure you knew who I was because I followed the whole Bay Area into Largo, Los Angeles, Odenkirk, like, you know, just that whole
Patton, whole thing.
Greg Barrett, all of the
Margaret,
all the gems.
Yeah. And are you still in San Francisco?
No. I'm down here and I just go up there for Sketchfest.
I want to do it.
You should totally do it. You should
totally
do it.
Want to bring Uncab.
I know. In fact, I know for sure we have talked about Uncab and like it was either not going it specifically at whatever the years, you know what I mean?
We took a little break,
But and Bart Coleman also a friend in common and a huge fan of yours and a delightful and longtime friend of mine.
Sweet.
And
yeah. Send him my love.
I will. Yeah. He's done so much for the alt comedy scene, just bringing it to the attention of networks and like what a champion.
Yeah.
What a champion.
So great.
And you're in LA too, yeah?
I am now. Yes.
Yeah. How long were you in SF?
I was never in SF.
You were never there?
Mm-mm.
So the SFers and the LAers sort of join to make like an Uber comedy scene.
Yeah,
when
I'm
most
trying
of them
to remember
down.
Who the first people from SF were that were. I mean, I think what happened was that Dana started to do the show.
Yes,
indeed. And that he was already here. But then I think through Dana, I think he was the conduit for a bunch of the SF people. I think I'm guessing.
Yeah,
something like that.
I mean,
yeah,
it's true that it's all just a beautiful fuzzy blur at this point for me, even going back that far as a fan, for sure.
Yeah.
And how did Uncab start? I mean, this is such a boring question, but now I get to ask you all the things that I didn't know the answers to all these many years that I've known about it and seen it and stuff.
Oh my God. The very original start of Uncabaret was I was doing comedy and one person shows, air quotes, and I was doing a show at a place called the Women's Building, which was a little arty enclave downtown LA. And you know how sometimes you're in an audience and you're like, I wish it was quite as funny as you thought it was, but you know, I'm going to go with it.
Unfortunately, yes, I do know that. I know that feeling very well.
And then you get a little funnier because they're laughing so hard. It was one of those nights. And after in the meet and greet, I was like, you know, when was the last time you guys laughed? Because it wasn't like quite that. This is not that quite that funny. And they were like, oh, we don't laugh. We're women and we're artists and we're lesbians. And if we go to comedy clubs, they just make fun of us. And I said,
interesting.
Well, when I get back from tour, I'm going to make you a show. It's going to be unhomophobic, unxenophobic, unmisogynist. It'll be Uncabaret. And I don't even know where that word came from. I do know that. So it was kind of a download, the decision.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I was frustrated in the comedy world. I wanted to get into comedy clubs, and I was into comedy clubs, and I was working in them, but I wasn't happily working in them. I didn't feel like I would say I was flourishing in them.
Yeah.
I didn't feel
it's such a specific culture. I mean,
yeah.
It's so specific from one club to the next in one city.
Yes.
Never mind, like, going across the United States.
Yeah.
That's not my bag. I'm forever impressed and shocked with folks who somehow
manage.
Make that work.
Yes.
That's not for me.
Well, and now it's a little, I have to say alt comedy has changed comedy clubs a little bit, but especially before anything like alt comedy existed. And there had been one night at the Comedy Store where I was following Andrew Dice Clay, And I just remember standing in the wings and I'm like, I hate him. I hate the audience for laughing at him. I hate myself for hating them.
Yes.
And then I was just so frozen.
Oh,
with
my
hate.
God. Well, I know. What a feeling to have before you're supposed to go on stage and charm people.
You know? Well, I love
so unfair to
I
you.
I love that you say that, to charm people, because I think I've always seen it as like so many other comedians are good with hate. And if they had only been that person, they would have just gone on and been, I hate you, and turned it into something funny. But I just remember in that moment having this, like, one of those CNN, you know, just billboard, you know, just running.
Yeah, like a ticker,
yeah,
like a
ticker,
ticker thing.
Yeah, like, yeah. There has to be a better way. There has to be a better way. There has to be a better way. And
totally.
I was just living with that, you know, and for many reasons, going back to, you know, early childhood, that I just really felt like something. And then when this happened and I was like, well, I'll make you this show, I still didn't know what it would be exactly. And I don't know where the word uncabaret came from. I wasn't a cabaret person. I don't think I'd ever even been to a cabaret.
I mean, that said, it's a great word.
But there it was. I mean, I'd been to the movie with my boyfriend and his boyfriend. Yeah. It was an immersive experience. So I don't know. Start where you are. And so I just started from this need of having, you know, something else. That was how I do go into the book. I just did this audio book, So You Need to Decide.
And yes, please tell everyone about You Need to Decide.
I do go into, you know, how it started. I talk about that as like a blink moment, you know, Malcolm Gladwell's blink moment, but that there was a whole lifetime of like staring before the blink. And so I think we delude ourselves into this idea that we can make these blink decisions without understanding like all that has to come before it. So
absolutely.
I go into a lot of what turned me into the person who had that moment. But and then it was a huge journey from there, you know, from there of that moment of figuring out what does on cabaret mean. At first, it's just a different context. And then what are we going to do? Anything that doesn't fit into the clubs. But then we move venues, and then we were at Highways, and it was just Taylor Negron and Judy Toll and I. And I think a lot of the DNA, I sort of think of it as like gestation, you know, insemination, gestation, birth. There was like Women's Building, Highways, and then Luna Park. And those were like the three phases of how it began.
Yeah. I was thinking about the last time someone brought up Taylor Negron, and I realized it was Paula Poundstone. She said when she was telling me when she came to LA and she was like sort of crashing with him. And again, just hearing these, you know, legendary folks feeling like, you know, they're because whenever, I mean, I don't know about you, there are things that people, even just with Sketchfest, which I've now done for, it would be 20 plus years, but because of the pandemic, it's sort of hovering. Yeah. We've been almost about to celebrate our 20th birthday for like 2 years.
I think you still have the birthday. It still exists, whether
still
or not
take
the
that
event.
Birthday.
Yeah, take it.
Yeah. So I have a 22-year-old child.
Yeah. I mean, when we celebrated on Cabaret's 25th anniversary, people were like, didn't you have your 25th anniversary 5 years before that? I was like, yeah, but it kind of depends where you count from.
I love it. I love it. I love that sentiment so much. Yeah, I mean, but when people are like, oh, you started this thing, and while objectively that's true, and I sort of look back on it, and I'm like, okay, but when you're in it, I don't know how many of us have, just exactly what you're saying about that blink moment. It's really hard to be like, here I am at the crossroads of something. Like, you don't necessarily, I personally, and I'm curious, I mean, it sort of sounds like you've already said that, is like, I did not feel the marking of time in that precise way. It was just this messy thing that sort of had all these legs, and you had to sort of chop a leg off over here, and then an arm grew over here. And within 10 years, you finally were able to look and go, oh, I think I have some perspective now.
Yeah.
Like 10 years. Years later, looking at the beginning. Yeah. And so, but from the outside, I absolutely do recognize, like, yeah, you were part of this movement that really drastically affected the way people perceived comedy, the way they engaged in it, took it in. And likewise, just the idea of how many other folks' material and acts and approach were informed by and inspired by and enabled by the kind of show that you were making available for comedians to do, not just for audiences to see, but, you know, I like as a person who dabbles but is in improv and in music and stuff and comedy, but mm-hmm. never in stand-up, depending on the showrunner and where the show is and what the vibe of the show is, you can end up getting inspired to do stuff you never would have done anywhere else. So I love that not only did you, you know, change and affect the experience for the comedy fan, but you helped shape some of these folks who, like, I don't know what their material would have been like if they weren't part of that kind of movement, you know?
Yes. I mean, and I have to say, Janet, at the time when we started, there weren't comedy fans. I mean,
it's like Bachelor and Bachelorette parties.
Yeah, I mean, there were still tourist buses coming to the improv.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I would invite my friends who were writers and artists and directors, and they'd go, I don't know, a stand-up show. And I'd go, oh, it's not like that. And they'd go, And slowly, you know, we were, the show was already, I believe, so, I mean, we had actually Highways, it really took off in the women's building, but when we landed at Luna Park and it was like an ongoing thing and we were really having to get audiences into this West Hollywood room and people were really resistant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
But then people started coming and loving it and bringing their friends. That was really, I mean, that's how it really took off, was word of mouth, their friends.
Sure.
And that audience was so much a part of shaping the show. They are a partner in this because they're listening. You know, one of the innovations of Uncab was the back mic. And the reason the back mic happened was because what I was telling people was just do the material. As I tried to figure out, like, what, as you said, you know, you cut off a leg, you thing the thing. And as I was figuring out what it was, I was like, okay, here's what it is. Do the material that your head is going to explode if you don't say it.
Yes.
Because everybody was doing these tight tens in the clubs and like there was all
slick.
There's this,
a slickness to that.
Yes. And there was just these giant like volcanoes of material inside of people. And don't forget, we didn't have any social media. That's how far away it was. So nobody had other outlets. You know, it wasn't like, oh, well, I'll tweet that movie.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, for sure.
All going on stage. So there was all the family stuff, all the love stuff, all the show business stuff. And you could still say show business stuff in rooms because there was no social media.
Yes.
I'm getting screechy on that. It was just crazy. So what happened was people started doing, you know, because the audience was coming back, we started to realize like, oh, we can't repeat material. That's how that rule happened.
Yeah.
And be in the now, don't repeat material. And so I had this back mic and I would start asking people questions because you know, when you're doing material for the first time, it's new, you miss stuff, you know.
Yeah.
People would get
derailed. Yeah. Maybe you lose your train of thought.
Or you get this great thing that you don't even realize is a great thing. And I'd be like, oh, that thing, go over there. That's really good. You know, so I would just ask a question. And I also learned from watching that the one thing that will keep an audience from laughing is an unanswered question. Like there's two things. The audience is worried about you or they have a question you're not answering. Those two things. So I was in the back of the room trying to help people stay away from those two things. So I would just ask questions. That was the whole reason for the back mic. And the audience I really became sort of a, you know, my laugh, people know my laugh. And I would sort of be like, oh, this is a funny thing. This is okay to laugh at and give people sort of permission to do long setups. I mean, part of it was rhythm. And I don't know if you don't work in comedy clubs for, you know, your listeners, the fascism of an every 7 second laugh means that you can't do any real setups. You can't talk about it. Anyway, I'm just blathering now, but that's,
no, you're I'm not. No, it's excited. All so true. And it's so good. I mean, it's so true. I mean, it's, I also love, you know, rapid fire, great, tight stand-up comedy. I have tremendous respect for, you know, sometimes it's not my cup of tea. Other times, you know, somebody like Patton can go into a rapid fire mode that is just as brilliant as like a long storytelling mode.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Oh, but, I love fast talk. I mean, don't.
Yeah.
And I love
just,
a tight
act. It just
act.
Doesn't have to be. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But that can't be the only thing.
Where does
thing.
It come from?
And where does it come from? And to the difference for me, again, going back to improv, but like, you know, I've done short form, I've done comedy sports, mm-hmm. I've done, you know, Who's Line kind of stuff, and I really have a great time doing that. But my love is with long form for the same reason. Like, I want a scene, I don't care if a scene doesn't get a laugh for 3 minutes.
Right.
If it's interesting and it's strange, or it clearly the performers are connecting, like, that feels great to me, you know, rather than feeling, again, that pressure. And you're so right about people worrying about you. Like, that's the kindest version of pressure from an audience, but it's so real. It's so real. Because if you're super worried about someone, you're also probably not laughing, or you're laughing nervously, or you're, I mean, like, you get in your head about it as an audience member, and ugh.
Yeah,
that journey can be very painful for everyone involved.
But I do think it has to do with kindness. I like that you say that. I mean, I do think it has to do with us not wanting to laugh at people as a kind culture. I mean, our culture gets such a rap as, you know, mean. But I see it in people that they don't want to hurt people, you know?
Yeah. Well, maybe that's why it's so awful when it's at its most impersonal.
Yes.
Because when you're tasked with being a human being in the same room with someone, you're like, oh, I don't have the desire to do any of those things that I do when you're just like words in the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, we're going to take a break. I will be back after a word from our wonderful buddies at Maximum Fun.
We have wasted this world. Our magic put a storm in the sky that has rendered the surface of our planet uninhabitable. But beneath the surface, well, that's another story entirely. In a city built leagues below the apocalypse, survivors of the storm forge paths through a strange new world. Some seek salvation for their homeland above. Others seek to chart the vast undersea expanse outside the city's walls. And others still seek, what else? Fortune and glory. Dive into the Aether Sea, the latest campaign from the Adventure Zone. Every other Thursday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I know this is probably in your book, but just because I like to dive in some into teenage years on the podcast, were you as a teenager, where did you grow up, and did you have that sort of, if it doesn't exist for you, you better make it? Did that come early to you, or was Uncabaret kind of an earlier, or was that one of the first times that you kind of had that development?
I think I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut. I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island, and New Haven, Connecticut. My teenage years were in New Haven. And I think I always did veer towards innovation. I went to Brown and I made up my own major, you know, art, dance, and modes of expression, art, dance, and writing.
Ooh, I love it.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, it was like, let's figure out, the idea was like different ideas are different. Oh, who cares about it? Well, whatever. So, and I'm trying to think, like, if I imagined myself to be innovative I was creative, and I think I like to invent stuff, like art-wise and different media. I was exploratory. So it didn't come out of nowhere. Definitely not. But it mostly came out of when I was 5, I had a blood disease and I was in the hospital, but I like felt fine. So it's such a weird thing. Like, you're sick, but you feel fine. So you never really know, like, what's what. And I think there was an experience I had there, which was watching kids in the hospital play doctor and thinking like, well, I mean, we're in the hospital. I mean, can't we play like house or school? maybe we could kiss. I don't know, anything besides doctor. I mean, obviously as an adult I realized that role playing and figuring it out,
right?
And then I think when I was then in the comedy clubs, I thought, and I was complaining, and I sort of all of a sudden one day in some shitty club in Encino, and I was just like, I mean, God, can't we do it different? And I was like, oh my God, it's the exact same thing as being in the hospital and thinking, can't we play a different game? And then realizing, like, I had never suggested another game. So I think that part of it is I always saw that things could be better. Why can't it be this way? I was always trying to figure out better ways for things. Mm-hmm. Like every teenager, like, why does there have to be war? I mean, if nobody shot anybody, there wouldn't be any war.
Right.
I mean, but I think because I realized like I had never suggested another game. So I think as a teenager, I knew I was different. I knew I was just, I just was different. I wasn't in a place that was extremely conformative. There wasn't, I mean, I see shows and movies and talk to Pete friends. And I didn't go somewhere where, I didn't go to a school where there was this like excessive amounts of conformity. I went to a small private school. I went to two different smaller private schools and, you know, they were pretty creative and it was encouraged. So being different was sort of to be the same.
Mm.
And so innovation was kind of part of it. And I guess I would say that there was I was like a cheerleader for the Jewish Center, though.
Listen, I'm a cheerleader for the Jewish Center. Every experience I've ever had at a JCC or anything equivalent in the Jewish community, I'm like, what? What do you mean I can't belong here full time? What's happening? This feels so right to me.
Right.
So
I did that in junior high school, kind of to get out of gym. But it's so you're a cheerleader, but it's for the Jewish Center. You know, it's like, it's weird. We went all around to the country. We had a really good Jewish Center team, but it was all the guys who they were in school, but they weren't tall enough or big enough or good enough to play on the high school team. There was that. And then I remember like I was dating one, like the center, and he looked like a Jewish Elvis and he was really cute, but he wasn't that smart. And I knew that. I knew. Like, I can't, these aren't my people. I'm not supposed to be with these people. But this is the end. This is the end of me. Even I remember really crying, being in my teenage room and just sobbing and sobbing because I couldn't quite imagine. I just was desperate to get out. Like, that was my main, I was thinking about my teenage years, you know, before we talked, and I was like, I just had this urge to just be done with it and get out. I knew I wanted to move to New York. I knew that's all I knew. Like, I'm going to move to New York. That was it. And
had you spent time there? Had you visited and had a sense, like, was there a very physical experience you had that kind of helped inform this is what New York is going to be like for me? Was it like my experience of New York until my 20s, which was never been there, only saw it in various people's films and stuff.
So you had a very romantic idea, I guess.
For the most part, yeah, I definitely did.
Something in between. My dad worked in New York sometimes. He had an office in New York and we'd go back and forth. He was in the clothing business. And so I did go in a lot. You know, I got my hair cut in New York. We would go shopping in New York. But I never had a realistic, like, when I was a senior in college and we went for, like, studio tours. I mean, that was the first that I saw of artist studios. But my mom would take me to, even when I was pretty young, I would go to the Museum of Modern Art. I went to the museums. We saw shows. Yeah. I would go in from college with friends and see art and shows. So I had a more realistic than just film and TV, but I didn't know what it would be to like, you know, try to find a place to live and afford it and have jobs and, you know, and make your life.
Sure.
But it was great. Those are some of my greatest memories that are living in. I loved it.
Well, I mean, I think that's an experience I sort of wish I had had, but I hate to say, like, because I feel like I've been saying this for many years. Like, I think by the time I hit 30, I was like, well, I'm never going to move to New York. Those days are done. Which, it was never a huge priority for me, but I think I left room for the possibility that maybe I would get a job there.
You still
might. Something would happen that would, I mean, I just would have to have more money than I maybe would have. You know, just.
Oh, yeah.
It's tough to, that is a tough town. And, you know, I have friends who moved to New York and very much were committed to the theater scene and stayed in the theater scene and still live like church mice, you know, but are happy because they are living the dream and, you know, they're not starring in a Broadway show, but they have significant, you know, secondary roles and stuff. But I don't know. It's hard. It's hard once you sort of get into a groove where you're like, oh, this feels like I have a home that feels like mine, yeah. and, you know, I've nested in yes. some way. It's harder to imagine the New York experience, I think.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people say, would you ever move back? Well, yeah. I mean, sure. Yeah. I mean, for the job that I don't know what that job is, but,
right, right.
you know, maybe for 6 months at some point in a, you know, I have friends that are successful media people who leave and, you know, let me stay in their 4-story West Village townhouse.
There you
this
go.
This is what
That's
happens.
What I want.
And this is
That's
what happens.
That's what I want.
This happens every time. Day 3. I can't believe I don't live in New York. Oh my God. I love it here so much. Why did I ever leave? What's wrong with me? And day 5, suddenly I'm like, oh, yeah, this isn't my life. I wouldn't have this life. But I always yeah. have like a small moment.
I do too.
Oh,
I get it.
A few days of like.
Oh, I totally get it. It might be like the first snowflakes fell when I was there. And like for that day, I was like, I'm packing up and moving here, baby.
Always.
And then 2 days later, I'm like, oh, I don't know if this is not for me.
I do love living in. I mean, I do love Los Angeles also. I still feel like a New Yorker in Los Angeles, even mm-hmm. though I've lived here for so long.
That makes sense, though. I mean, I think that's common. And I felt like a San Franciscan in, and I'm not even from San Francisco, but having lived there for almost 10 years before I moved down here, I definitely identified as a San Francisco person living in LA.
Yeah.
And then at some point, for something shifted for me. And it probably was Sketchfest, like going up to San Francisco and every year still having a relationship with the city, but realizing like, wait, I'm ready to go home
yeah.
at the end of Sketchfest.
Yeah.
I have to accept that means my home is Los Angeles.
Yeah.
If I'm like, because there was a time where I was like, I don't want Sketchfest to be over. I just want to stay here, you know.
Yeah.
And that did shift. But I'm interested. Yeah. The idea of, I mean, I'm probably like drawing some very crude parallels that are oversimplifications. But the idea of being in a smaller school and kind of being different, being the norm, and then going to a school like Brown, which I've had lots of friends who have gone to Brown, and I have that jealousy that you have, or the envy that non-Brown people have when their friends are like, oh, no, we met at Brown. And I'm like, you're not even saying anything braggy. You're just saying you met that person at Brown, and I'm still feel like you're bragging because I know you had this great experience at this school. So now I'm assigning braggadocio to you being like, oh, I just said we met there. You literally asked me how we met, and I said we met at Brown. And now you're mad at me. But that, I mean, that.
I have to say, I do always hesitate to say it for that reason. Sometimes I'll just say
you
college.
Totally know.
I'll say college. And people go, well, where did you go? Go on, bro.
Well, and I don't care. When people talk about going to Harvard or Yale or Stanford or any of those schools, that's kind of doesn't mean this. I don't really care.
Yeah.
I'm just like, oh, yeah, Ivy School, good for you. But because of the friends, the type of people who are attracted to Brown and who came out of Brown that were in my life, I was like, oh, that sounds like a pretty great experience.
The friends was one of the main things that came from it. I mean, you know, that friend in New York, you know, and
yeah.
it wasn't even a group of arty friends. I mean, sometimes I think one of the greatest things was that I have friends that are in other areas besides the arts because
sure.
of Brown. But I do think that one of the proto experiences that led to Uncabaret happened there, which was this thing called the Funny Room. I lived in sophomore year at what was then a new dorm in Pembroke, which was the women's school that had merged with Brown. And it was the Pembroke campus. Anyway, it was a new building. And there was this weird common room that had no furniture in it. It was oddly shaped. It was small. It had indoor-outdoor carpeting with a bench. It had a cut out like window in the wall that went into a hallway. It had rheostat lighting. What was it? I mean,
uh-huh.
what was it for? I mean, you know, reading,
yeah.
I guess. But uh-huh. what happened was my friend group and I ended up meeting there. We would have these events. I don't know how it started, but here's what would happen. At lunch, somebody would go, like, let's go to the funny room. Funny room. Funny. We ended up calling it the funny room.
Yeah.
And somebody would steal a Boston cream pie and a spoon. And we would go, we'd get so high. And then there would always be like 8 to maybe, you know, 16 people. And then finally, when we were so high and we needed to eat something, somebody would start chanting. I can't believe this really happened. It's like this. Somebody would start chanting, oh, great pie.
Oh, great pilots.
It was so crazy. And then we would take...
You invented your own, like, hasty puddings, like, group. Yes. Like, an informal, like, you were the Freemasons of the funny room.
We were the Freemasons.
You're like... The joke Freemasons.
Oh my
I love
God.
It.
And then the pie would go
oh,
around.
Great pie.
And then after the pie, people would pop up and go behind into the hallway area and do shows in this little window.
In the window.
In that
That's
little
awesome.
Window.
Oh, I love that.
And when I say to them, though, that group, like, you know, it's funny how I got into comedy and I just was so serious that, I mean, I have this impression of myself because I was like a modern dance choreographer and a printmaker and a nude model. And I didn't necessarily remember myself as like hilarious. And then they were like, your show's in the funny room. Your shows.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, that was, and it was very much like Uncabin, that it was a group. It wasn't a closed group. People would bring friends, but it did have a family feeling. It had a supportive feeling. So besides the fun of it, there was community. And I think community, and you must find this with Sketchfest also, the community of it is one of the most important things. And
absolutely.
The people who are drawn to it are drawn to wanting that.
Absolutely. Oh, I love that. I think that makes so much sense. I mean, that idea, especially the idea of we're going to show up to this. Isn't necessarily a set of expectations that have to be met, you know, so that when magic happens, it feels really special. And when it doesn't happen, it doesn't matter because you're still having
pie.
A good time because you showed up and you still have fucking oh, great pie. Which, by the way, I'm very glad. I have not thought about Boston cream pie in a minute, and I could not tell you the last time someone offered it up to me. And that is a damn good pie. I mean, that is just like, because it's like sort of pudding-y, right? I mean, you're sort of eating
sort of like
this just
banana
very
cream.
Sensual.
Or, very sensual.
Much more sensual than like a pecan pie where you have to kind of gnaw your way through it, even though that's
God.
Like sugary and good.
But so much chewing.
I love that it was Boston cream pie. That's perfect. Who gets the cherry? Isn't there always one cherry on the top?
I don't think at the cafeteria they bothered with the cherry.
They were bothering with the cherry.
And you only got one bite at a time.
I bet it tasted so goddamn good.
So goddamn good.
Oh, I love it. No, that makes absolute total sense. Were you? You spoke about the Jewish Elvis that you that you dated from the center team. What was your dating life like in college? Did you feel like you had a better selection of kind of kindred spirits?
Better, but you know, I think that at school I found there was a lot of jocks still, and there were a lot of science nerds. After the Jewish Elvis, I hooked up with one other guy in high school. And I was a senior, so I kept saying, you know, I don't have to fall in love. You know, it's like, I know we're both leaving, but somehow, fell madly in love. And so we carried into freshman year. He went to art school in Philadelphia, and he decided he couldn't do a long distance relationship, and that was just a torturous breakup.
Flirted with a long distance relationship. I just can't. That is a lot to ask
it's
of
a
two
lot.
Young people.
Yeah, it is. So
when you're just like everything's constantly stimulating,
and you're trying
and,
to figure
you know,
out who you are. And, yeah. Yeah, do you think? Yeah. So I mean, it was him, but after that, I fell in love with. I don't think I've ever gone on one date in my whole life. Maybe three. I'm not a dater. And so I ended up with somebody who was in our friend group, and we were on again, off again for the rest of college. He was gay, bi, I guess. Mm-hmm. And at the senior year, that joke about cabaret is true. At the senior year, there was another guy, and we hung out, the three of us, a lot. While they were really falling in love, and they're still together. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And we're friends. Wow. I mean, you know, it was hard then, but it wasn't hard in the same heartbreak way. The things that were hurtful were more about the longing to be with my people, which I felt I wasn't. I just felt so hard in my heart that I just was, I lived in the suburbs and it just seemed bleak and it seemed
Yeah.
Culturally devoid. It wasn't really, because I could go downtown. I mean, and I do write about this in the book, the Yale New Haven Art Museum was a haven for me. And I think I made a lot of life decisions sitting and looking at one particular Hopper painting.
Oh, that's great.
And I had a great English teacher who, this is crazy, my high school English teacher is now my therapist.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Holy shit. So this is a person who's known you, whether or not you stayed in touch through that entire period, but who has a sense of you as an adolescent. I mean, I feel like a lot of therapists would be really envious of that. Like, damn, you got the inside scoop on teenage version of that?
Yes.
That's helpful.
Knew my parents.
That's
so
amazing.
I will sometimes miss something and she'll be able to go, well, you know.
That's awesome. That's almost intimidatingly cool.
Isn't that great?
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
That's a blessing.
Oh, it's time for a quick break. I will be back after a word from our friends at Maximum Fun.
A man goes to the doctor and says that he's depressed and that life seems cruel. The doctor says, ah, the treatment is simple. The great clown Pagliacci is in town tonight. Go and see him and you will surely feel better. The man bursts into tears and says, but doctor, I am Pagliacci. Ah, okay, says the doctor. In which case, try listening to the Beef and Dairy Network podcast. The Beef and Dairy Network podcast is a multi-award-winning comedy podcast, and you can find it at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
I got to get into this MASH game with you, which I don't know. If you haven't heard the podcast, you may not know what MASH is.
But I have heard a bunch of it, but I don't mind.
So it's this game that I started playing through just other friends in grade school, and it's just a way of celebrating wonderful things that we love.
Okay.
That's one way of putting it. But I'm going to create these categories, and you're just going to give me off-the-cuff answers. It'll be like three foods you love.
Okay.
It will be very simple. But
okay.
For this first category, I'm going to ask for three places in the world, whether you've been there or not, that you would love to have a second home. And we're going to assume we can just sort of teleport you there,
okay,
so you don't have to worry about the travel.
All right. Well, Paris.
Wonderful.
New York and Bali.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. So next one I'm going to do, I mentioned the foods thing. Let's do three foods that in this reality, maybe you feel are ecologically you shouldn't partake of, or you have an allergy, or you just wish that you could eat an entire Boston cream pie and not feel sick. All of the negatives are being taken away in this false world that we're making. I don't want to say false. This fictitious, beautiful fantasy world that we're creating. Everything, there's no ramifications. So you can have
but
it at the snap
I
of your fingers.
Me? Am I still me?
You're still you,
all
but
right,
you're
so
not going to get
alcohol.
Sick. You're not going to. I mean, that's always the question. That's always the question. It's like, my sobriety.
All right, I will go with that. Okay, bread and butter. Bread and butter. I could
great,
just eat
great.
Bread and butter all day long,
yes,
every
indeed.
Day.
Indeed.
Love it. Bagels and butter. No, bread and butter cover all the breads and butters.
Yes. Yes, that covers all the breads. Don't you worry.
Okay. I guess I'll say Boston cream pie because it's on our, because we're already talking about it. You would eat all the time, though. God.
Whenever you want it. I mean,
oh,
it's not like,
you
don't have to eat. It's all up to you. It's just like, and it could even be like, oh my God, I had this one baguette in Paris that I had spread the brie on, and there were the cornichon, a little arugula, and I've never been able to get something that tasted
that sounds
that good.
That does like sound that. Good.
Okay,
all right. A Greenblatt's, which is now closed.
Yes.
A Greenblatt's Cobb salad.
Oh, perfect. Perfect, perfect. Oh, listen, I'm tell you, I agree on get me the right Cobb and I'm so happy. Get me the wrong Cobb and I'm like sobbing.
But Greenblatt's closed and it's really tragic.
I know. Yeah.
So, okay. All right. Let's not dwell.
All right. We're not dwelling. Next category is three movies that you can jump into whenever you want. You're not reliving the plot. You're not a character. It's just getting into that world.
Okay.
So
okay.
It could be this version of New York, or it could be Star Trek, or it could be Dune, whatever.
Okay. The Philadelphia Story.
Great.
The X-Files.
Great.
And what about some great New York What movies do I love, Janet? It's been so long. All I ever do is watch Nine to Five. I would get to be with Lily,
that's
Jane,
a great
and
one.
Dolly.
Oh, my God. That's fabulous. What a great choice. Okay, beautiful. Love it. All right, let's do some fictitious romantic partners. I'm not asking you to make a long-term commitment to any of these people. It could be, or it might be a one-night stand. That's all up to you. It can be anyone, living or dead. It could be a character from a book, a character from a cartoon. Actor, a politician, who cares?
Okay. Three. I'm gonna say both Gillian Anderson and David Duchovny.
Could not agree more.
And then for number three, Cary Grant.
What a doll. What a doll. Okay. Next category, let's do three musicians that are basically making a soundtrack of your life for you. So it's going to be all new original music.
Oh, wow.
Just for you. That sort of helps like encapsulate a day in the life. And it could be one song will be a good day in the life.
All
one
right.
song will be a tragic
I live
day in
with
life.
A musician and he is constantly making music that is the soundtrack of my life.
I love it.
So that's that. He and his music, Mitch Kaplan, is it's in the book.
Oh, sure.
So that,
yeah.
That, yeah. So
that's, oh, that's fabulous.
Yeah,
but nice. Fuck him, because
fuck
this
him.
Is an alternate universe.
This is another
universe.
Thing. Yeah. This totally is an alternate did. Universe. Well, Phoebe Bridgers. I would say Phoebe Bridgers.
Great.
But could I have Phoebe Bridgers and Joni Mitchell? Because that's a lot of that.
Like as your second one, you
yeah.
have Joni?
Yeah.
I would.
Okay. I've met her. I've had been to her house. I know. That's,
oh, God.
That's a flex.
That's a flex, but I'm happy to hear it. Anytime I could be one degree of separation from Joni, I'm on
pretty good,
board.
Right?
100%.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Nirvana?
Great. All right. Let's do three artists. It could be Hopper. It could be Martha Graham, artists from any media.
Okay.
That three that you would love to collaborate with on something, and you don't even have to know what that is. Do you know what I mean? You could just be like, I want to work with this person. I don't even care. I don't know. I can't even tell you what it's going to be, but I want to do something with them.
Oh,
living or dead.
Wow. Gosh. All right. I want to write a song with Taylor Swift.
Amazing. What a great use of this. Absolutely. 100%.
I want to do a museum something with Marina Abramowitz.
Marina Abramowitz.
And I actually played her in Sex and the City.
That's amazing. Exactly.
She's that artist that sits in the museum and, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. And just being her for 2 days was so crazy.
Yeah. I love that.
So that would be fun. And then, yeah. Oh, my God. You said Martha Graham. Wouldn't it be amazing to do a dance theater, living or dead though? Oh, what about Stephen Sondheim? I want to do, but then I already did a music project with Taylor Swift. Can I get rid of Taylor Swift?
She's right. in and
it's
she's
a
out.
Three-way. It's a three-way with Taylor Swift and Stephen Sondheim.
Sondheim, great.
It's a.
I'm going to allow it. The court will allow it.
Okay, and then I want to do the dance thing. I do want to do a dance thing with. But so in this, I'm actually able to dance because it's a fantasy. I'm able to do things that I can't do.
100%.
Okay. So what at Fosse? Fosse. I want to do dance. Great. I want to dance with Fosse. Oh, I did meet Baryshnikov when I was on Sex and the City, and I had a dream about dancing with him before I knew I was going to meet him. But I think it would be amazing to do. All right. I already had that dream. Sticking with
you
Fosse.
You had that dream. I love the Fosse. Yeah. I think that's great. See, I'm as a tall girl. From the minute I found out how tall Baryshnikov was, I was like, nope.
Oh, God.
Like,
no.
I'd have to lift him, and that would be very embarrassing. shouldn't be in a gender equal society. I shouldn't feel like an Amazon, but I don't think it would have the same
I'm
feel.
Always really, I do think it's a big gender thing, because when I see a taller woman with a younger man, I do have a little minute of good for them. And that is so wrong. I shouldn't have to feel that.
But I appreciate you saying that, because I do the same thing. And it's like, oh, something's still occurring to us about this. Therefore, we ain't there yet.
That's
you know,
right. Yeah.
It's so true. You're so right.
I'm catching
That's
myself.
A great point. That's a great point.
Checking myself so I don't wreck myself.
Exactly. Okay. Next one. Let's do. Well, you brought up the could I do what I can't do now. So let's do three skills that we can just gift you with that you are superb at.
Oh,
tomorrow morning you'll wake up, be superb.
Oh, my God. You can do anything. I love this. Mm-hmm. Wow. Sorry, be more creative than do your own hair.
Well, I it's mean, your game, baby. You want to do your own hair.
I don't. I love seeing David. All right, let's see. I mean, singing. I mean, who doesn't want to sing better than they can and the best? Singing.
Great. Love it.
Singing and dancing. I mean, singing, dancing, and painting. I wish I could just do those three things better. You can, because anything else you could just, I mean, it's the things you can't hire people to do. It's the things.
Yeah. No, you're right.
Yeah. All right.
I think it's a great, those are great choices. Okay, final category. Let's do, I mean, listen, this might be a melancholy way to end, but you just talking about Greenblatt's closing and stuff, are there three things that you would like to bring out of retirement or things Ooh. That no longer exist? It could be you bring a person back to existence. It could be, and I understand that we're fucking with destiny, yeah. fate, or whatever, like bring back the dinosaurs are going to kill all the animals. Not like that. But, you know, bring back Greenblatt's, bring back a certain, you know, artist, or bring back like the thing that the style of blank. It could be totally surface and it could be totally deep.
Okay.
It's up to you. It's,
oh, all right.
There's no wrong answer.
That's a lot too. Gosh, I feel
know.
Like a goddess. Well, what about this? Why don't we bring back a women loving culture, life
Great.
Before misogyny?
Great.
I'd like to bring back a world where people dressed up more. I hate the schlumpy world.
Yeah. I'm saying, yes, I'm wearing pajama pants. I'm like, oh, I know. And then I like slowly move my knee down out of view.
You look so pretty. You dress up. I mean, you can still dress up in pajamas. I mean,
that's a good point. That's a good point.
You know, it's not what the items are. It's how they're, you know, it's the how.
Yeah.
It's not the what. And then a third thing I'd like to bring back would be, I just want to bring back like clean air. God, that's, I'm so boring about this. Let's see. I can.
No, it's great. Listen, when no one was driving in LA in like spring of 2020, it was like, ooh, what is my, oh, my lungs are, I guess they're larger than I thought they were.
Right.
And really feel it.
The birds, like the sound of the birds, you would walk outside and you were like, oh my God.
Yeah.
And I really thought this, I'm such a silly optimist and a dreamer wrapped in a bubble.
I did the same thing. I know what you're going to say. And I did the same thing.
I wrapped in a bubble of, you know, comedy, you know, cynicism. I thought that was a change that was going to happen.
Yeah.
I
was like, everyone recognizes how special this is. And like, we could do this. We could do a version of this, if not exactly this, like we can take this moment and take the lesson, right?
Yeah, I think the reason we keep getting these variants is because I feel like at first we were being told to go to our room. Fine, we did. We thought about things. We came out. We haven't changed. So we keep getting sent back in. I mean, that's the spiritual explanation, but whatever.
That makes a ton of sense. And you're not the only person saying that. That's for sure. Okay. I am going to ask you to give me a word, just one word that sort of helps describe like your mood when you woke up this morning.
Excited to see Janet Varney.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and use just excited. That's a lot of letters. And while I'm going to use this word to do my eeny, meeny, miny, moe kind of scenario that will give us the outcome of your 100% guaranteed MASH alternate universe life.
Okay.
Will you tell everyone about the book and other places, anything else that you would like them to know and find and enjoy about you?
Sure. Well, the book, So You Need to Decide, is an original audiobook, and it's available everywhere you get your audiobooks, Audible and Apple and everywhere else. It's a mix of a conversation I had with everyone from, I should just look at my list, Margaret Cho, Phoebe Bridgers, Isaac Mizrahi, Dana Gould, Bob Odenkirk, a lot of your favorite UNCAB people and others. And then my own narrative of decision making, much of it around UNCABaret and deeper. We talked about family, we talked about work, we talked about love, we talked about spirituality and moving. And about the process of decision-making itself. It's funny, and according to people, it's comforting. people are starting to tell me they're finding it comforting and helpful.
That doesn't surprise me.
And so that thank you, sweetie. So that's that project. And it's eight and a half hours of it. So once you pick it, I love to pick something that then I don't have to keep deciding on things. Like you get a good thing and I watched every episode. We watched every episode of The X-Files during lockdown. It was the greatest thing. And there's like 13 seasons of it. All right.
I am so glad for you. Well, first of all, was there anything else you wanted to say?
Yeah, I just would say Uncabaret is still live and vital, and we are doing Zooms. We did Zooms. We pivoted to Zooms March 17th, and then we kept doing them. We're on our 40th Zoom. They're happening now once or twice a month, depending on where we are with live shows, when the variants allow us to do a live show. We're also there. So find me on social and find Uncabaret on social. I'm Beth_Lapidus on Instagram and Beth_Lapidus everywhere else, and Uncabaret as well. And just get with it.
Get with it, everybody. I have some news for you that I'm very excited to report based on the thing that you just told me about what you watched during quarantine, which is that not only did you watch every episode, but from here forward, you can jump into the X-Files whenever you want. And not only that, and I'm just going to put this in here because how can I not include this when I deliver that news, is that you are romantically entangled with David Duchovny. So
oh my gosh. It'll
be a sexy, exciting opportunity for you to jump into the X-Files. And I think that means like you have access to, I mean, obviously you also have access to Jillian, but you have access. I love the idea that you have access to the characters of Mulder and Scully, but you in your own life also have access to your hot smoking relationship
it's
with David
so
Duchovny.
Complicated. I love it. I You've given me a dreamy, complicated life.
I encourage you to just sing about it because you have a flawless singing voice. And I can only imagine that when you're staying in your apartment, your chic apartment in Paris, there are going to be opportunities for you to do a little bit of maybe not Uncabaret, maybe Cabaret, as well as the fact that if you want to include a little bit more, maybe some movement, something like that, along with the singing in this beautiful place in Paris or anywhere else you happen to be, know that Bob Fosse is by your side.
Oh my God.
Helping to enhance your performance in the show itself into something absolutely fabulous. Oh, I'm sorry, that's not enough for you, and you also want a soundtrack just made for you by Joni Mitchell? Don't mind if you do. Don't mind if you do. That also leads to, listen, all of these things going on, you're going to be very hungry because you'll be very, very busy. I want you to know that you can have that perfect Greenblatt's Cobb whenever you want it. It will appear magically in front of you in its perfect form, perfect flavor, and perfect ratio of items inside that cob. And I feel like we're getting a lot of really female positive stuff coming out of this conversation and this mash. And perhaps that is a bellwether of the fact that you are bringing back this absolutely women cherished, celebrated, misogyny free culture that is coming up into frame through this MASH game. How about that? You feel pretty good about that? Because
God.
That was an amazing outcome.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Beth, this has been such a pleasure, as I knew it would be. There was
so
no question
fun.
In my mind that us getting finally a chance to really sit
finally.
Down together would
I'm
be
so happy.
A joy and
yeah.
a pleasure. Congrats on the audiobook. I have my own copy. I just haven't had a chance to read it yet, to listen to it yet, because I just got it yesterday. But I'm very excited, and it has lots of my heroes.
I hope you
enjoy
it.
So you're a hero.
You're a hero.
And thank you for continuing to bring all of that.
Thank you.
What a joy. We'll get you up at Sketchfest.
That's so much fun. I feel this is just our beginning.
I absolutely agree. The show is produced by Julian Burrell and Christian Duenas.
And as always, the JV Club theme song is Back Before We Were Brittle by the amazing Say Hi.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.